Welcome to Israel War Briefing, a podcast from the Jewish Chronicle, the oldest Jewish newspaper in the world. I'm Jake Wallace-Simons, editor of the Jewish Chronicle and author of Israelophobia, the newest version of the oldest hatred and what to do about it. In each episode, I have a one-to-one conversation with someone worth listening to. This week, it's my honour to welcome back to the podcast Rich Goldberg, who is the former director for countering Iranian weapons of mass destruction for the White House National Security Council, and is now the senior advisor at the Foundation of Defense for Defense of Democracies. Rich, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, quite the couple of days for us and for you and for Israel. Perhaps to start off, can you just give me a snapshot of your reading of what's happening right now? We're in that weird period between the Iranian action and the Israeli response. What's your take on what's just happened and what might come next?
Yeah, I think the first initial reaction, which is the right one, is to commend obviously the Israeli military, but the United States military and the UK military for working so closely together, not just in the last week, but over many years in developing the missile defense tools, architecture, and tactics for a moment like this. Obviously, there was a week of planning to try to get this one done. There won't always be so much notice in the future. But credit to the Sunak government for being a part of this effort, helping knock down drones, missiles out of the sky with the United States as well. A very significant moment of partnership, I think, historically, and not just with Israel, but with Arab countries as well participating. Jordan and Saudi Arabia in particular opening their airspace and potentially even intercepting over their skies as well. That's the good news out of this. And we need to reaffirm that close type of partnership for all that we do. And remember that threats to cut off arms sales to Israel, whether it's in Britain, follow through in Canada, does have consequences in the region. The Iranians see these things. They act on these perceptions of weakness and isolation of Israel. So let's stop doing that in Britain, perhaps. But more importantly, I think the next step is to reflect on, wow, this is a massive attack. This is unprecedented. I don't know anybody who was standing around predicting ballistic missiles, certainly not 120 ballistic missiles, were going to be a part of any response scenario here from the Iranians. We had been hearing about cruise missiles and drones. Maybe it would be proxies. Maybe it would be some from Iran. But when you step into the idea of launching ballistic missiles at that scope and scale from Iran towards a country the size of New Jersey, that is a strategic level attack. It is unprecedented in its nature. And so that follows into two questions. One, what are the policies that we've all embraced in the West that have led the Supreme Leader to the point on Saturday night that he believed he could do that and get away with it without any consequences? And number two, what are going to be the policies going forward that turn that calculation into a miscalculation? Because it's not a miscalculation just because 99% were shot down out of the sky. It's not a miscalculation because Iran gets some bad PR for a few days and people say attaboy to Israel for a few days. It's a miscalculation only if he pays a major price for doing it in Tehran. If the Supreme Leader takes an unexpected amount of costs for what he just did to change the calculus going forward. If that does not happen, this is the new baseline. Just like we have a new normal of missiles and drones going into the Red Sea and missiles and drones coming into Israel from Lebanon, you have a new normal of ballistic missile warfare in the Middle East coming from Iran. That's just a Saturday night now in the Middle East. That can't be allowed because right now those missiles are not nuclear tipped. Right now those missiles don't reach London or Washington. We know the ambitions of the Iranians is for both to be true one day. And so this is the moment for Iran not to internalize that there is basically nothing they can do they will not suffer a consequence for from the West. The line has to be drawn somewhere. Okay, so what are those policies? What are those consequences coming? The policies, in my view, are a combination of accommodation of the regime, appeasement, if you want to use that word, whether that is multilateral sanctions relief, the UK's refusal to join in snapping back the UN sanctions on Iran, unilateral sanctions relief, the United States opening up cash spigots, allowing oil to flow to China, the British government not being willing to put the Revolutionary Guard Corps on a terror list, Canada as well, the EU as well. These are all steps that have been accommodationist towards the regime. Why don't we do any of these things? We have terror plots in London tied to the IRGC. We just had a stabbing of an Iran International anchor. Why don't we do any of these basic things like put the IRGC on a terror list? Why? We're afraid of escalation. The Iranians might not like it. They might escalate. So everything becomes this argument of escalation, all the way to the point where they can launch 120 ballistic missiles and still face no major consequences. Something has to change here. So that's the first piece, the accommodationist approach. And then the second piece is the political isolation and attacks on Israel over the last several weeks in particular. Threats to cut off assistance, political warfare against the state on a daily basis, trying to make them isolated on the international stage. That has consequences. That emboldens Israel's enemies, who are our enemies. And so, what do we learn from this? Number one, close ranks with the state of Israel. Show dramatic cooperation, coordination, like what was done on Saturday night. Make that the norm going forward. Take disagreements that are tactical in nature behind closed doors, not out in public, to appease certain left-wing audiences. The Canadians better lift that arms sale embargo ASAP. And by the way, Britain, the US, all Western nations should be putting major pressure on Trudeau to do that. I think it's our responsibility to push Ottawa on this immediately. That's a problem. And certainly don't listen to any of the Hamas protesters in the street to do it in London. And then that, so that's one piece of the equation. The other piece of the equation is returning to true pressure and isolation on Iran. Will you put the IRGC on the prescription list? Will you actually snap back the UN sanctions? Will the President of the United States cut off money flows in different ways and enforce our sanctions on oil? Or are we actually not going to even have political and economic costs, let alone military costs, on the regime for what just transpired? So those are the thoughts that are going through my mind up front.
And one of the responses, which you haven't mentioned, is a military response on the Iranian regime, but that's what we're all waiting for. Now, we don't know what the Israeli response is going to be. There is a sense that there is one coming, but it was really striking to me that the Biden administration came to the defense of Israel in that dramatic and impressive way, which echoed the way in which he sent those two aircraft carrier strike groups to the Eastern Mediterranean after October the 7th. So once again, this great bear hug of defense. And yet, as soon as the immediate threat passed, he returned to the rhetoric of almost castigating Israel for daring to consider some kind of response. He came out and said, or an official in his regime, in his administration, said that they wouldn't partake in a strike on the regime, openly and publicly, which then I could only imagine the Iranians sitting there hearing this, thinking, great, that means the Americans have got our back. You know, the Israelis have been deterred now. I mean, what do you make of all that?
Well, listen, a lot of the signals that I've seen come out in the last 36 hours do not give me a lot of hope that there's going to be a major policy shift. And maybe the threat of an Israeli retaliatory strike is what drives some sort of a shift as Europe and America are looking to stop Israel from doing what they should do, and that is defend themselves and impose a heavy cost militarily on Iran for doing this. But if they are going to try to pull Israel back and tell them, no, don't do that, what is it that they intend to propose as an alternative? You know, what is the United, what is the plan here? A G7 statement? That's going to do it. That's going to stop 120 ballistic missiles as the new normal in the Middle East being launched against Israel? That's insane. Are you going to move forward with any of these political and economic measures I've just listed? Because if you're saying that you don't want a military escalation right now, what are you proposing to do that otherwise imposes some sort of cost on the regime? The reason why I don't talk about the military side as much, I believe it's necessary. I think there's a window here to support a strike on the nuclear program entirely, IRGC architecture, and really stop being, you know, held over a barrel by Tehran for the decades to come as we continue to see their march towards nuclear weapons and long-range missiles. This is the moment that should wake all of us up to the threat once again, that we need to stop the threat now before it gets too far, before we face a Russia-type situation in Ukraine, where we are deterred far more than we are today when they actually have nuclear weapons with long-range capabilities. But I think the test of whether anybody's actually serious is whether they're willing to do the low-hanging fruit.
Right.
Okay, I understand military action is hard, but is it hard to put the IRGC on a prescription list? Is it hard to send a letter to the Security Council asking for the snapback of UN sanctions? Is it hard to withdraw a sanctions waiver in the United States? These are not hard steps.
Right.
So you show me very quickly that you're not willing to do anything even easy, let alone hard. That's me perceiving that. How's Tehran perceiving that? And what does that mean for the future?
Well, let's stay with the military option just for the moment, because that's what we're all waiting for, at least from the Israelis, if not from the Americans as well. Whenever the subject comes up in debate in Britain, and I'm sure in the States as well, in many quarters, the reaction is, well, that would lead to World War III, and nobody wants that. Therefore, let's not dare to respond at all. And if the Israelis have to respond, let them do it all by themselves and on their own head, be it next time. But let's just game out what an Israeli, let's say in a fantasy scenario, what a joint Israeli-American operation might look like and what the global repercussions may be. Is there a way of doing it hard and doing it right and avoiding that kind of global conflagration that everybody fears?
Sure. I mean, there is a robust way of pursuing maximum damage to the Iranian nuclear program that would be led by the United States. That seems unlikely given the current president. It could be unlikely in the future president as well. There is not a lot of stomach in the United States for launching that kind of strike, just given the potential retaliatory options that Iran still has, given its missile force. That said, if you look at the history of the regime, so long as it's not a decapitation attempt, but they fear decapitation could be a result if they fight back and enter direct warfare with the United States, the regime has always stood down at some point, something performative, but then a stand down measure. We saw that happen, obviously, in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan. To some extent, we saw that after the Soleimani strike. There's an argument where they're trying to compare what happened on Saturday night to the aftermath of Soleimani. I think the scale of what just happened is hard to compare that
Just,
to the reaction to the Soleimani strike.
I mean, just for our listeners, the Soleimani strike was 2020. Trump authorized the drone assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Revolutionary Guards, and the Iranian response was pretty lame at that point.
Well, it was a ballistic missile response. So there's a corollary there. It was directed at a U.S. military installation in Iraq. There were injuries, traumatic brain injuries reported. There was time and signaling to prepare for a potential strike, to batten down the hatches, so to speak, in preparation, which I think averted many casualties,
But also,
and likely.
but to put it in context, Qasem Soleimani was a way more iconic target than the people who were hit and the Iranian officials who were hit in Syria by the Israelis. And the response was an order of magnitude lower than we saw
Correct.
on Saturday night.
That is correct.
Do you think that was to do with who was in the White House?
Well, I think it's absolutely had to do with the fact that the United States was the actor that took out Qasem Soleimani, not the Israelis. And the United States has far more military power behind it. And if the President of the United States shows a willingness to use force and to escalate, the Iranians have to take that into calculation very quickly. Whereas if they see the Israelis escalating, and they threaten major escalation in response to Israel without US support to escalate in response, you therefore can win the escalation game against the Israelis potentially. And that's sort of what, at least for now, is happening if, in fact, Israel is pulled back from having any major retaliation that imposes costs.
Right.
So in some ways, the Iranian calculus is proving all correct here.
And
And
I
that's
suppose,
very troubling.
right. And the, I mean, as by way of illustration, the American defense budget is what, something like $850 billion. The Iranian one is something like 9 billion, and the Israeli one, something like 23 billion. I mean, that's the kind of scale we're talking here.
That's right. Now, the missile force is large. It is large. And they had a lot more missiles than the 120 they launched ballistic missiles there on Saturday night. They have more cruise missiles and obviously a lot of drone manufacturing capacity. So the threat from that asymmetric perspective is large. Some of these more strategic threats are large. It's not a ground force threat. It's not an air force threat. It's not a naval threat, really, per se. Some terror type naval assets to mine the Gulf or to swarm with boats. But you're not really looking at anything other than their missile force, which is a real threat that we have to deal with. Now, missile defense is one way to ensure that the first wave gets knocked down, but it's not to become a turtle. It's not to just take it over and over again as escalation increases until at some point you run out of interceptors or you get overwhelmed.
Right.
It is to give you defense to survive the attack and then counterattack.
Right.
This is a problem if you think about the strategic paradigm that Israel fell into with Hamas, believing that it was invincible to Hamas pre-October 7th because of the Iron Dome. You risk getting into the same conclusion that, well, we have the Arrow missile system to take out ballistic missiles. We don't have to worry about Iran anymore. Well, that's outrageous. And basically, it's not a risk calculation that anybody's going to take with Iran, because these are a different caliber of missile, the different threat level than homemade rockets in Gaza. And certainly, if one day they are nuclear tipped, it is the existential threat to the state of Israel.
Right. And so to return to what we were saying about gaming out a possible response. So you're saying there is a possibility of a robust response targeting principally the nuclear sites, but also, I suppose, other military assets along the coast or elsewhere, without evoking World War III, which is what everybody is afraid of.
Yeah, listen, I do not want to downplay what that picture looks like. I think that you would have to prepare for a short-term crisis, and Iran to be retaliating in certain ways for the short-term duration of that operation. That does not a long-term conflict picture. It's not a campaign-type operation by the United States or by Israel, if it's just Israel undertaking it. I can't predict how many days that would take, given the target set, and what kind of damage you're hoping to inflict on various targets, what sort of assets will be required for that, et cetera. But it's not months, right? It's likely not even weeks with an S. And so if Iran wants to de-escalate at some point after they realize they have gone too far and they have paid a price and they don't want to have regime decapitation at the end result, they will find a way to de-escalate. That is not to say we will be casualty-free. I hope we would be. I think you have to have eyes wide open anytime you're advocating military action of the risks involved. There will be economic short-term risks as well, as far as dislocation and disruption, potentially in the Gulf or the Red Sea or elsewhere. So all of that has to be taken into account. The question is, if this crisis is going to occur, when is it going to occur? On what pretext is going to occur? What is the triggering action by Iran that forces it to occur? Are there no red lines? Is there a red line? Is going to towards a nuclear breakout a red line for this to occur? And what does the world look like if there are no red lines? And that's the internalization from this incident. And they do acquire nuclear weapons in the future.
Right.
What does that world look like?
And this is a little bit like what the Israelis sometimes call a controlled crisis, where you accept a level of crisis with advanced planning so that you can contain it. But that would be significant, wouldn't it? Because it would involve the activation of Hezbollah on Israel, the Houthis, of course, closing
Correct.
Global shipping and affecting the global economy, militias such as Qataib Hezbollah in Iraq and others in the region. And the real fear is that with the American forces engaged in that theater, the Chinese would then take the opportunity to invade Taiwan, splitting American forces potentially into the Indo-Pacific, and then Putin would fire a missile on London and invade Estonia or Moldova or Poland. Those are significant fears, aren't there? Real fears, that the danger is that once you light that touch paper, you can't tell where it's going to spiral next.
That is a scenario, and you have to have a contingency for all scenarios. It's an extraordinary scenario, but it's not an impossible scenario. It seems unlikely today that China wants to trigger that today, but that scenario might be possible in a year or 2 years or 3 years, when they know they're at overmatch for us in the Indo-Pacific, when they're more confident. But I'm not saying that it couldn't happen. This is why we're in a serious state here, where we need very serious options on the table. Iran today, though, is not nuclear armed. And so that is still an element of helpfulness to take action against Iran now, not later. So once Iran crosses the nuclear threshold, we're in a brand new world.
Right.
And in many ways, they've already shown their hand the Saturday night on where they would take us in that brand new world. So whatever uneasiness, contingency planning would need to be taken into account, that needs to be taken into account quickly before there is a race towards that nuclear breakout, at which point you've lost that window of opportunity potentially. And Russia and China have increased their emboldenedness and their timing of events like that, because now it's not just a conventional force in Iran that you're looking to defeat or set back. You now have three different nuclear powers, plus North Korea still allied and partnering with those countries as well. So potentially four threats of a nuclear power status. That's a pretty scary world. That's a pretty scary world, especially when Iran is the one that also sponsors terrorist groups throughout the Middle East, plots terror attacks around the world, Hezbollah obviously with major operations around the world. If their sponsor now has nuclear weapons, again, the umbrella that provides for the terrorist operations abroad is also next level. So you have to weigh all these cost-benefit analyses and really make a decision of when is the moment to remove the threat. And in the end, the United States just may not have the stomach for it, and the United Kingdom as well, which leaves it all to Israel, unfortunately. And
right.
Then the question of when will they do that, under what circumstances, and will we at least understand all of that all that context, all of that understanding of why Israel needs to do that and why it's not just in Israel's interest, but in America's interest, because the scenario you just laid out argues pretty strongly for helping Israel do that, or at least tacitly allowing Israel to do that, supporting it in preparations, executions, and defense after it does that, so that we maintain our postures in other arenas and prevent Iran from crossing the nuclear threshold. These are interesting conversations, and they're important conversations. It's also a little bit abstract and disconnected from the reality, which is the United States right now doesn't want Israel to touch anything,
right,
let alone the nuclear program, and certainly isn't going to do it itself. And so the reality of life now is America trying to pull Israel back from any major retaliation to this strike, and a question of what is our policy going forward that doesn't allow this regime to believe it can do anything without military consequence, the logical next step being the nuclear threshold at some point.
Right. So, I mean, if we bring ourselves back to what is likely going to happen rather than what could happen, we are almost certainly going to see some kind of Israeli response, the Israeli doctrine being to defend, be able to defend itself by itself. That's the sort of the phrase they often use. So there's going to be something coming. Presumably, it will be likely muted by international pressure, which for some reason I don't understand has been played out in public, which can only embolden the Iranians and make them feel like they've got away with it. But that's for another day. And the Americans look to be set on probably option one of the three that you laid out earlier, i.e. continued attempts at appeasement. Could you just sketch out for us how we got here? I mean, what happened? So Biden comes into the White House following Donald Trump's policy of maximum pressure, under which he'd pulled America out of the JCPOA, which was the Obama era nuclear deal. He'd applied this maximum pressure. Iran had basically shriveled up in terms of its assets and its reach. Its nuclear program had not stalled, but it slowed at least. So Biden comes into the White House. What took us from there to here, when you can have 300 missiles raining on Israel and the Biden administration still says in public, don't do anything?
Well, you have a pledge to go back to the nuclear deal from the campaign and then into day one. And then you have a series of steps that Iran takes to escalate in various ways to see what the U.S. response will be. And at every single turn, invariably, the response was offers of accommodation and not any sort of punishment, whether it's coercive economic punishment, political isolation, not even talking about military response. And so we think it was in January of 2021, as the president was in transition, that was when they first crossed the threshold to 20% enriched uranium, going from very low levels of enriched uranium, even though they were breaking the cap of the JCPOA under Trump after he left the deal. They never got to that next threshold of high enriched uranium, particularly after Soleimani was killed. It's a very interesting dynamic. If you look at the small steps that Iran was taking in 2019 in response to the U.S. cutoff of the oil exports through our sanctions, really trying to ratchet up maximum pressure. Started playing with some advanced centrifuges in June 2019. They restart enrichment at the Fordow facility in November of 2019. They've crossed the threshold during that summer as well, the 300 kilogram cap of enriched uranium under JCPOA. And then Soleimani's killed. And they don't escalate further in the nuclear program until Donald Trump's on his way out of office. Very interesting. There's some other, you know, militia attacks and things that, that continue here and there. DOD responds to it. But in the nuclear realm, there's really no escalation. That starts again January 2021. And they want to see, okay, new president's coming in. We're laying down a little marker here. He says he wants to go back to JCPOA. What does he do? We just went to 20%. He appoints Rob Malley, very known Iran appeaser, as a special envoy for Iran, continues to offer to go back to the Iran nuclear deal, takes the Houthis in Yemen off the foreign terrorist organization list, withdraws the notice the United States had given to the Security Council of the snapback of UN sanctions that had been disputed, saying U.S. policy is opposed to this. We don't believe in the snapback. We haven't done it. Don't worry. And makes offers to go back to the nuclear deal still. What does Iran do in response? Well, two things. One, they go to presidential election and they select like the face of the Islamic Revolution, Terror Inc., the human rights abuser in chief of Iran. Really, they call him the hangman of Tehran. Ibrahim Raisi becomes president of Iran. So the veneer of, you know, Hassan Rouhani and the moderate forces in Iran, they're gone. We're going full, you know, tilt towards Islamic Revolution, 1979, death to America, death to Israel. We're going to kill anybody who gets in our way. He fills a cabinet full of sanctioned individuals wanted for terror plots around the world, red notices out on them from Interpol. So it's literally the Terror Inc. cabinet that the Supreme Leader puts together to say, okay, you still want to negotiate? Come back to us now. The United States still goes back and says, hey, well, let's talk. They've now ratcheted up their enrichment to 60% from the 20% high enrichment uranium, 60% being a stone's throw away from weapons grade uranium at 90%. I know that sounds like it's not a stone's throw from 60 to 90, but you just have to look this up on a technical basis of how you enrich uranium and get to weapons grade levels. The 60 to 90 part is the small threshold. It's going from 5 to 20, that's really big, and then 20 to 60, that's kind of hard. The 60 to 90, much less hard, especially when you perfect how you use advanced centrifuges and put them together in the right way, called a cascade, to help you produce that high enriched uranium.
Right, 60% doing is 20% to 90%, they say, don't they?
Exactly, 90. Right. Yeah. It's confusing, all these numbers, but you know that's why I say stones throw away. So they're installing more advanced centrifuges the entire time. They're building up, they get caught producing uranium metal, a core component of nuclear weapons. They start limiting the International Atomic Energy Agency inspections in different facilities. They hold hostage tapes that the IAEA was making of their centrifuge manufacturing plants, so we don't even know where they're diverting advanced centrifuges to at this point. All of this happening, and all the Americans do every time is hold back pressure, no sanctions. In fact, we'll relieve sanctions here and there. We'll grant a waiver here and there under our sanctions. At the IAEA itself, no censure resolutions. We'll pull even the Europeans back. Amazingly, we've become less hawkish than the Europeans on Iran in certain arenas at the moment, even playing out in the last few months. Okay, so what's Iran learning from all of this? That it can get away with anything. It can keep moving towards that nuclear threshold and get offers of economic relief. Now, last year, after the dust had, you know, supposedly settled from the almost revolution in Iran after Mahsa Amini's death, the Kurdish-Iranian woman who had been killed, 22 years old, for not wearing the hijab in Tehran to the regime standards when she was on a trip with her family, national uprising sparked by that. That was the one moment where you saw in Europe especially, but even the United States in the Biden administration, everybody say, ooh, we can't keep doing this accommodation stuff, at least not now. Got to wait until this settles down from the news. Killing women, not a good look for us. We can't reward that. you know, the whole terrorism and missiles and nuclear threats and destroy Israel, you know, assassination plots against Americans. Yeah, we can deal with all of that. Ooh, they're killing women now. That's a bridge too far for our politics. So we can't afford that. We're not actually going to put any major sanctions on. We're going to do individual symbolic sanctions for a while and see if we can get to the other side of this crisis to continue accommodation. And that's what happens. In fact, last year, the United States approaches Iran and says, hey, can we start opening up spigots of money and let you send unlimited amounts of oil to China? In exchange, you'll stay below the 90% weapons grade uranium threshold. And could you not send short range ballistic missiles to Russia? We know you're already sending drones. Don't like it, but don't escalate. And could you not keep attacking Americans in the Middle East? Don't like it. Don't escalate. And Iran suddenly comes into a windfall last summer, a major windfall on oil exports going above 2 million barrels per day for the first time since the JCPOA period. I mean, massive increase from where we were in 2020 at the end of the year. $6 billion being made available to Iran in a supposed hostage ransom payment deal. You'll remember last fall, $10 billion being made available out of accounts in Iraq. And then October 7th hits. And what is our response to October 7th? And this is not just our response to the United States, but your response, United Kingdom, everyone's response. Nothing, really. Nothing. Downplay Iran's connection to Hamas. Iran's not behind this attack. We don't have any intel. 10 days later, the UN Security Council's embargo on missiles is going to expire. 10 days after October 7th. And all the United Kingdom and France and Germany with U.S. support has to do is send a letter to the Security Council to snap back the Security Council resolution and stop that embargo from expiring. And they don't do it. They won't do it. Fear of escalation. Okay, what is Iran learning from all of this? The sanctions waiver I talked about, the $10 billion, gets renewed in November, a month after October 7th. Gets renewed again last month. In the interim period, three Americans killed in Jordan by Iran-backed militias. Missiles are now raining down on the Red Sea from the Houthis. Missiles are raining down on Israel from Lebanon. International pressure is coming on Israel, not on Iran. So how do we get here? Not hard to understand how we got here. My question is, where are we going from here? Because we can't continue this. This just leads to more and more and more escalation by Iran, which is ironic because everybody is against any step to coerce Iran, to pressure Iran for fear of escalation. In fact, what I just drew for you is an arc of accommodation that has only led to escalation.
Absolutely. I mean, chilling, absolutely chilling sort of domino effect of a response to American appeasement. But, you know, the only thing that seems to me that's going to change anytime soon is the election of Donald Trump, potentially. If that happens, do you see that as being a potential game changer in the region?
I think it could be in many ways. I think there's a lot of Humpty Dumpty that needs to get put back together again, and genies out of bottles, whatever metaphor you want to use. So that will be a challenge up front if the former president comes back into office. The Saudis, for example, have cut a peace deal, a truce with the Iranians and with the Houthis in Yemen. And they don't seem like they want to get out of that deal. But a turn back to maximum pressure is going to require some cooperation from the Saudis there that they may not like. They may get squeezed by the Iranians. What's going to happen there when the Saudis call up and say, please, you know, we don't like this, don't do this. We're going to be in the crosshairs. The Houthis are going to attack us again with missiles. What are you going to do this time if Iran attacks our oil infrastructure, if the Houthis are attacking Riyadh? We need to have answers to those questions prepared.
Right.
There's a question as well, by the way, of the acceleration of the nuclear program over the last 3 years and where Iran stands technically today with nuclear weapons capability. Is there time to rely on economic pressure alone? I don't think so. There's going to have to be a military card on the table at the very least to stop progress and allow economic pressure to advance. And perhaps in fact, to take that largest weapon, that extortion device of the Iranians, off the table quickly and allow economic pressure and political isolation to focus on the other myriad threats that Iran poses, non-nuclear, like the terrorism, like the missiles that we just saw on display.
Right. I mean, do you think that Donald Trump would bring with him a sort of a return to the flavor of the madman theory that that was popularized under Nixon, where he tried to cause the communists to think that he might just be insane enough to properly let them have it with the nukes or whatever? Do you think Trump brings that kind of aura with him? I mean, you know, Trump might actually be a madman. I mean, you know, who knows? But, you know, do you think he brings that kind of deterrent?
I think he does to many of our adversaries. I think that comes with discomfort for our allies oftentimes as well. So it can be a double-edged sword of the unpredictability. But it oftentimes with our worst adversaries, if you look at a North Korea, if you look at an Iran, if you look at Russia, even though this is not popular opinion and conventional wisdom on a lot of centrist left-wing newspaper columnist headings, the president's policies and his willingness to show strength at key moments created unpredictability for our adversaries, which made them recalculate how they were going to escalate or if they were ever going to escalate. So these are important steps. Now, you know, there's the old Chinese proverb of you need to kill the chicken to scare the monkey. Mm. And so there's always a need to do something to reestablish your credibility in the arena for other major actors to take a look at. And so the president will need to reestablish his belief structure, his doctrines, his willingness to use force when necessary to protect U.S. interests. Otherwise, it's very easy to pretend, oh, well, you know, maybe Tucker Carlson and isolationist factions are really in charge now, and the president's not willing to do things, and he's a Twitter tiger. He's not a Twitter tiger. And I'm confident he'll take some actions early on to demonstrate that and make our adversaries recalculate.
Right. Just to pick up the thread of the Saudis that you mentioned earlier, I mean, it struck me that when from a Saudi point of view, I mean, don't forget, they also took part in shooting down these drones and missiles from Iran, which was an important step given the supposed peace accord that they signed recently. But from their point of view, I thought that they would be looking at this extraordinary international operation to defend Israel that took place on Saturday night, and that was 99% successful. And they would have cast their minds back to 2019 when they came under ballistic missile attack from the Houthis on behalf of the Iranians, and it wiped hundreds of millions of dollars off their oil production and damaged their facilities and was very, very costly and difficult for them. And that would have made them think, well, you know what, maybe normalization with Israel, which comes with a potential defense pact with the states, maybe we want that more than we did yesterday.
Oh, I think that there's a strong case to be made there that, A, the Saudis are reminded of the threat that's closer to them than to Israel. And what if 120 ballistic missiles was pointed at Riyadh, not at Tel Aviv or Jerusalem? What does that look like? And a reminder that Israel is the actor that's willing to take on Iran in the region. And if at this moment the Americans come to the Saudis and say, hey, we know you wanted our defense commitments, we're willing to make them right now, especially after Saturday night, and we want to see you normalize with Israel, and we're not going to make Palestinian issues a holdup to this. We're going to get this done for the region, for stability. I think it's possible. I think it's possible.
Great. Well, Rich Goldberg, thank you so much for joining me, and I hope to have the benefit of your analysis again very soon. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Israel War Briefing from the Jewish Chronicle with me, Jake Wallace-Simons. Join us next time for more insight and analysis from leading experts.